The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.
Welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show, EDU edition. We're on today's show. We're actually going to talk about a listener's email that was sent in to us I believe you could describe it as clearly some frustration about getting straight answers to some what seemed to be pretty straightforward questions, getting straight answers from financial advisors slash financial planners that they were interviewing to help them out with their financial planning needs. So Jim has the details on this particular email, but when we got this in, there was enough topics in there, and we hadn't really talked about this for a while. We've mentioned a few of these things in the past on the podcast. But it just kind of resonated, some of these things she was running into. And so we thought we'd tackle that today as far as our EDU show. And welcome to July. This should be playing on July 1st is when this gets released. So, oh, one other thing I'll mention. The gentle, soothing sounds of rain in the background is because Jim is in the office here in the recording studio. We have both of the windows wide open, and it's raining outside. So if you notice that, maybe it'll improve the sound, the aura of the show.
And thundering and lightning.
That might be the scary part every once in a while.
Every once in a while you hear a big boom of thunder, perhaps.
So that's what that is. It's you're not hearing things. Yes, you can hear rain in the background. Oh, there's a little thunder right there too. So hopefully we'll keep power and be able to record the show here. But okay. Welcome, Jim.
Welcome. So today, folks, I got this email. We got this email not too long ago. A woman. We're going to protect her anonymity, and I'm not going to mention much about her per se. But she was scheduling what we call a coffee and a second opinion phone call, folks. That's kind of where you would contact the office, speak to either Chris or myself, just in an effort to see if there's a way we can help you. And if so, we'll explain how we can help you. And if we don't feel we can help you, we'll explain that as well. And that's all the coffee and a second opinion phone call was. Well, she had sent us a list of questions that she wanted us to talk about on said phone call. And I remember telling my admin staff, who is now Brett, as we've said many times, Laura. She is, I guess we would call her stay-at-home mom. Is that what you would call her, Chris?
Yeah, she's at home and has a baby now. So,
stay-at-home mom.
For now, yeah.
So Laura is a stay-at-home mom, and Brett has stepped into her shoes. And he sends me a copy of her questions and says, Jim, these are the questions that someone would like you to answer on a coffee and a second opinion phone call. And I pointed out to Brett, and he agreed, the questions were far more specific and didn't involve whether or not Chris could assist them. It was very specific questions about a specific topic. How does she interview a financial advisor? And I told Brett that on these types of phone calls with either Chris or I, we don't really talk about specific questions and spend our time trying to help people. We'll do that on a podcast. And since she's a podcast listener, I said, I think her questions will be great for everyone to experience. And that's why we're talking about this today. I thought her questions were beautiful, Chris, and highlights something that you and I probably a thorn in our sides, and that's really how the financial services industry works and how much they go to great lengths to really hide what it is they want to charge you, what it is you might be paying, what it is they might even be doing, and why they even do it. And it's just something ugly about our industry. It's rampant. If anyone out there says it doesn't exist, I feel they're lying or being disingenuous. It does exist. This industry needs to be far more clear, far more open. And I think, Chris, it's also very difficult because she, even this emailer, bops back and forth in her questions between an investment advisor and a financial planner, and she's equating the two. So before I even get into her email, I want to spend a brief moment of time, because Chris, you and I have mentioned this repeatedly. An investment advisor is not a financial planner, and a financial planner is not necessarily an investment advisor.
Now, they could be both.
They could be both, absolutely.
They could be both, but it doesn't, just because they are one does not mean they are both. They might just be the one thing.
And oftentimes what you have are investment advisors, people who are really just trying to give you advice on your investments and charge you a percent of your assets. In the industry is called AUM, assets under management. They want to charge you a percentage of your assets for the privilege of managing them. And they call themselves financial planners. And that's where the confusion comes, Chris. Because an investment advisor, and there's nothing against dedicated investment advisors. We have absolutely nothing against them. We offer investment advisory services at our firm. We have nothing against it. But oftentimes, people whose business model simply involves gathering assets and managing them, they call themselves financial planners. So people who are looking not necessarily for help in managing their assets, but simply advice on their financial situation, are getting pulled in to where they have to either release all their money to this firm in order to get a question answered, or they're trying to get an investment advisor to answer a question that they may not be well schooled in. And conversely, you could have someone who is a really good financial planner who all of a sudden is being asked some rather deep investment management questions, and their level of knowledge may not be up to par on providing deep investment management answers. That's why at our firm, we actually employ what we call an outsourced chief investment officer. CIO is the initials. In other words, we have hired a chartered financial analyst. Their acronym is CFA. No, that would be an initialism, right? Because it's not an acronym.
We true.
It's initialism.
Nice for picking up on that.
Good at
picking
up, exactly. Yeah. Their initialism is CFA, chartered financial analyst. But these are guys and gals who eat, drink, and sleep investing. They know more about investing than anything. I would say, Chris, it's a very prestigious designation.
Oh, it is. Very rigorous to get different levels. There's three tiers of testing that must be passed with the requisite education to go along with it. So it's to be a full-blown CFA, Chartered Financial Analyst, is very prestigious. And pretty much means you know your stuff in that area. For, I mean, I would rely on that. If I saw that somebody had accomplished that, I would easily assume that they know their stuff in that area.
Right. So a CFA is a specialist in investments, but they may not be as well schooled on planning, financial, general financial topics and planning. So in our office, Chris and I are CFPs, Certified Financial Planners, and part of our
education,
thank you. Curriculum.
Close. Curriculum.
Curriculum.
Close. Just move on.
Whatever. Part of the course we had to take is an investment course. Mm-hmm. But our forte truly is on planning, if you can't notice on our show. It's truly planning. So we've hired a CFA in case we ever get hit with something deep on investments. We can call, his name is Travis, we can simply get a hold of Travis and say, Travis, help us with this, or what would you do here? And Travis is the one who watches our portfolios and manages them, manages the models, tells us when we should be rebalancing, does the due diligence on all our funds. Okay, why do I share all this with you? Because part of the problems you're going to see, Chris, that this listener ran into is I think she was interviewing investment advisors and trying to get financial planning. And in some cases, she was talking financial planning, talking to financial planners, but she was asking questions about asset management. Please understand, folks, even though in our industry it looks like an investment advisor is a financial planner and a financial planner is an investment advisor, the fact of the matter is they are two separate disciplines. There may be some overlap. Travis, our CFA, he knows things about retirement. He knows about IRAs and Roth accounts and things of that nature. But he doesn't know half as much as Chris and I know about retirement planning. And conversely, Chris and I know a lot about investments. We know a lot about our portfolios and our models. But when we get things that get beyond our level, we go straight to Travis because that's his level of expertise. So as you're interviewing planners, the first thing you guys need to figure out is who do you need to hire, Chris? An investment advisor or a financial planner?
Right. So determine the needs you have, I guess, and go searching for the right thing, which is the first challenge. You're going to start reading her questions. I actually haven't read them, but that is a challenge because there's so much blurred lines between these two areas, people trying to appease or appeal to the masses. So they'll use terms like financial planner when they really aren't what most people would classically think of as a financial planner. They do a little bit of financial planning on the side, but they're mostly investment advising. So it can be tough to find, even if you know what you're looking for. I suspect that as Jim reads through these, we're going to find that she had trouble identifying who she should even be talking to answer her specific questions.
Okay. And I do want to give one quick shout out because we mentioned the CFA designation is one that we admire for the investment management. And yes, I did bring on board a CFA, but there's another designation, CIMA, that I do also respect. It's kind of like CFA Lite. That's kind of how we look at it. They don't get as deep into a lot of the investment topics, but for model management and ETF and mutual fund analysis and things like that, CIMA designation is very, very good.
Yeah, there are a lot of designations out there. And I will say that someone who's disciplined and dedicated to learning their craft might be very skilled and not have the letters after their name.
Right.
But at least if you see that they have achieved these types of, recognized labels, some third party has judged them as having known, they know this stuff, where you really wouldn't know on your own until you experienced it. And maybe you turn out, in hindsight, it was a bad idea. But there are certainly people that are super smart that aren't CFAs that know everything under the sun about investments.
Absolutely. A lot of do-it-yourselfers.
Never went through the program itself to get the designation.
Right. A lot of the do-it-yourselfers who listen to this show probably know a lot about investments as well.
Yeah.
But anyway, CFA and CIMA are two designations on the investment management side that Chris and I respect. On the financial planning side, it gets a little more difficult. But obviously, we're a little biased. We like the CFP designation, Certified Financial Planner. I also respect the CPA/PFS. PFS is... Was it Personal Financial Specialist? Something I think is what it stands for. It's kind of like the CPA's version of the CFP, if
right.
you will.
Yeah.
It certainly doesn't have the cachet of CFP, and it's a lot longer, CPA/PFS. But it, too, is a very good designation if you're looking for a financial planner. And are there any others you want to throw out there that you would...
Oh, there's a number that are more that aren't as broad scope as the CFP, that are more specialty type of designations. And I don't want to, I'm not going to list any specifically because I don't want to leave one out and upset someone, maybe a colleague, that because I didn't seem to respect one over the other. But there are others that are quite good, that have a very good education program, and they become quite skilled in that one particular
right.
area.
Right, that's
that
a good point. I think the CFP and the PFS, CPA/PFS, are the two best designations for a broad understanding of financial planning. And then there are some more specialty designations for those who want to specialize in, like, divorce planning and retirement income planning has a few.
Yep.
Chris and I don't bother going to get those. We don't see any benefit to us on that. We've been doing this for over 22 years. But there are some for retirement income planning even one for estate planning, not an attorney one, but one that is a financial planner that wants to specialize in that. So you could find some designations on the financial planning side closer to a discipline that you might want. But the two best known and widely respected for a broad understanding of financial planning topics would be the CFP and the CPA/PFS. Okay, so let's get into this listener's question. Hopefully you get the point. Find out first. Don't just say, I need to hire a financial planner. What are you looking for? Investment advice? You need to hire an investment advisor. You're looking for financial planning advice? You need to hire someone who specializes in financial planning. But the term financial planner, anyone can use it. And that's what causes a lot of the problem.
It's not controlled.
No.
It's not trademarked anywhere. So anyone can claim to be such
a thing. So you have investment advisors saying they're financial planners. You have insurance agents saying they're financial planners. You have financial planners saying that they're financial planners. Now, you can't say you're a certified financial planner without being one. Nor can you say CPA/PFS without being one. So that's why having those initials at least show, hey, I am dedicated to this craft and this is my specialty, is personal financial planning. Okay, so she begins, and I'm going to skip the main beginning part because she shares a little bit about her job, where she works, and I want to protect her anonymity, so we're not going to get deep into that. I won't even mention what state she's from. It is not Colorado, though. So she begins, here are my questions. Number one, what do I ask when choosing a financial advisor? I tried asking Jim's why question, but no one seems to understand it. And then she says, I will give an example of what I do. And I'm not going to read it, folks, because again, I want to protect her privacy. But within one, two, three sentences, Chris, not very long, she did an excellent job describing what she does. Took three sentences. Mm-hmm. But she's having trouble asking the why question. So let's back up, Chris. Remember when we did our five-part series in January and February about our retirement planning process? Mm-hmm. The first two shows were about why we do things the way we do. Mm-hmm. And I shared with our listeners one of the most important questions you can ask, whether you are hiring a financial planner or an investment advisor, you should ask them, why are you going to do things the way you do? Why are you going to look at my retirement this way? Or why are you going to manage my portfolio this way? And they should be able to answer the why. But she freely says they can't answer it. That they don't understand what she means. So we're not going to rehash why Chris and I approach retirement the way we do. And we're not going to rehash or even explain to you right now why we manage portfolios the way you do. But if you came into this office, or if you called us in these days of COVID and not come into the office and said to us, Can you guys explain to me why you manage money or will manage money the way you intend to manage it? Or why are you going to approach retirement the way you're going to approach it? Chris and I could nail that with our eyes closed because we know why. We believe passionately in it. We have a process. We have a discipline. We have an approach that is rational. We can defend it. We can explain it. And to me, Chris, the why is still an important question. What are your thoughts?
I think it's important, and that will really separate the wheat from the chaff, if you will. That may not be one that Jim's familiar with, since you're not in from wheat country. But
wheat from chaff?
Yeah.
I have no idea what you even mean. I know what wheat is, but I don't know
what
chaff is.
Most people know what that means. So
it's chaff,
the cream
of
the crop. We're trying to get the, you know, separate the mundane, the normal average planner slash investment advisors from the premier ones, because the premier ones will have thought about it this deeply and will have formed the basis for their approach, asking themselves, why am I doing it this way? And then be able to relay that to you. These people probably have never been asked this question. The public isn't trained to ask a question like this. They're just trained to, you know, trust the experts. You know, I go to my, you ask your friend, oh yeah, I'll send you to my guy or whatever, you know, that's the typical referral. And they're just not used to it. Now, pressed, some of the better ones could probably think about it and get back to her with their why, but they were taken off guard because she's probably the first person ever to ask that question. Unfortunately, with most of them, the answer is going to be because somebody, when I was young, showed me this is how we do it, and I just never questioned it. This is just how we do it. Or this is just how it's been done in the industry forever. There's just no questioning it. That, unfortunately, is the fallback for the vast majority of them, I would predict. There will be some that have thought about it deeply enough to have a why, and they just couldn't necessarily articulate it on the spot. And then I think the really good ones would be able to just answer it right on the spot. Might be few and far between, and that's, I don't know where she's searching in the country. She might not be in a mecca of financial planners and investment advisors, so maybe the pool is pretty shallow where she's at. But she could be in, you know, in the thick of a large metropolitan area with plenty of this kind of, quote, talent out there, and she's finding it difficult to find the cream of the crop out there. Don't give up. I think they exist everywhere, but she hasn't run across them yet.
So she does ask, what questions should she be asking a new financial advisor? Well, there's going to be different questions, again, listener, if you're looking for a financial advisor who's more of a planner, or are you looking for a financial advisor who's going to manage money, act more as an investment advisor. So let's look at the planner side first. What should you be asking? I, again, would lead with why. Not you could say a little bit about your background. That's an open-ended question, but I would definitely ask that. Can you tell me a little bit about your background, your training, your experience, your education? And see, did they go to school for this? Did they go to college? Do they have any designations after their name? If they do tell you, oh, I am a certified this or a certified that, ask them to explain a little bit about that designation. How is that designation going to help you? What does that designation require? What did you have to do to get it? Some designations are merely you go, well, before COVID, you go away literally, Chris, for a weekend. You fly out on a Friday. You attend classes all day on Saturday. Sunday afternoon, you're taking a quick little exam and you're flying home. And all of a sudden, you have a certification. There literally are some certifications that are that easy. Then there's others that are much, much more involved. You actually have to take courses. You got to study. You got to take exams. You have to put more into it. And there's some designations like the CPA / PFS and now the CFP. Prior to, at some point, you didn't even need a college education to get a CFP, but they had changed that.
Now you do.
Mm-hmm. But some designations don't require any type of college degree or training. So it would be good to find out about the person you're interviewing, and don't be afraid to talk to them about it. But also, if you're interviewing a financial planner, make sure they're schooled in the questions you have.
Right. Which means up front, you're going to have to share with them what needs you have, what questions you're coming with. Is it retirement planning needs? Is it education planning? Is it legacy planning? Is it tax planning? You'll need to share, and a good advisor or planner will ask you up front some questions to get an understanding. How can they possibly sell you on what they do until they know if what you're looking for is something that they supply? So there should be a good conversation at the front from both sides, and a respectable person on the other end. If they're not skilled in what you're looking for, should be referring you out. They shouldn't just try to fake it. But some Q&A back and forth, you'll get a sense, and knowing their background and what they have focused on doing, we'll see if that you'll be able to determine if you're aligned together properly, that your needs, the questions you're bringing, they are skilled in those areas to answer them. And so you are going to need to approach this with at least a clear enough question set in your mind to know what to be looking for. Because you can't just go interview people saying, oh, I know I need financial advice, but I don't know what kind. Right? It's going to depend on how old she is, what she's planning to do. My guess is if she's reaching out to us, she's probably got retirement-related questions and then maybe some auxiliary questions attached to that, like taxes or estate planning needs, or she could be still in the accumulation phase. You said she's still working, so maybe there's still some years left in the accumulation phase. But I'm just guessing on that. But she needs to share with them and see if those things are aligned properly. But they should be able to go back to the why. Looks like we are aligned. Describe to me how you go about answering my particular questions in that area. And then from that, a natural question is, why do you do it that way?
Exactly.
Now, she might have jumped up front with the why. And maybe it would have come out differently at a different point in the conversation and they'd understand what the heck she was asking. But that's just conjecture. I don't know.
And if you go to the CFP's website or even just Google questions to ask when hiring a financial planner, you're going to get a bunch of questions. The unfortunate thing is they're pretty much all rehashed. And a lot of them, to me, don't really get deep into what you should be looking for. One that just makes me laugh is, are you a fiduciary? And again, fiduciary is the catchphrase nowadays that everybody is talking about. That's where you're supposed to put your client's best interest ahead of your own. Are you a fiduciary? Everyone and their uncle will answer yes to that now, even if they're not, because most people think they are. And some people don't even know, or some advisors don't even know if they are or if they're not. And you can have some who are technically not fiduciaries because they're brokers, others who are planners like Chris and I, and we are fiduciaries. And then you can have duly registered, they call them, where you can be a broker where you're not, or a fiduciary where you are, a planner where you are. It gets very confusing. But the reason Chris and I are hesitant on trying to hire someone just on that, and we shared many a times on this show, last year alone, state regulatory agencies and federal regulatory agencies brought more cases against investment advisors registered as fiduciaries for doing the wrong thing than FINRA that regulates brokers, the quote-unquote non-fiduciaries, did against them. In other words, there were
more enforcement regulatory actions against these fiduciaries than the non-fiduciaries.
So just because someone calls themselves a fiduciary doesn't mean they're not going to do something nefarious. You cannot legislate morality. That's what I was trying to get at. I probably didn't explain it very well, but that's what we mean. Nor do I really think you can say, oh, if someone is paid a commission and they're not a fiduciary, they're not going to do something good for me. And someone who is going to be paid a fee and is a fiduciary is only going to do good things for me. Again, I have met some brokers who are smart and trustworthy as the day is long. And I have met some investment advisors / fiduciaries who I think would. I want to be nice here. I wouldn't hire if I was looking for someone. So
I think the best thing I would say on that is take the fiduciary label as generally a good thing, but don't look at it and then let your guard down.
Exactly.
You always have to be wary. You always have to ask the right questions. Don't stick your head in the sand and say, oh, yeah, my fiduciary is taking care of all of that. I never question anything they do. You need to watch out for yourself. Just because they're a fiduciary, like Bernie Madoff, who was legally a fiduciary, if people were paying attention and holding him to task and asking the right questions, he wouldn't have gotten away with what he got away with for so long. Just didn't happen. And maybe it's because people just trusted, since he was a fiduciary, never to question what was going on. So just keep your guard up is the basic. Because I'm sure people think, well, then what do I do? That's what you do. You try to watch out for yourself, ask the right questions. Nobody will be bothered who's ethical in answering the questions, because they'll understand why you're asking the questions. So,
exactly. And again, look and chat with people. If you're looking for an advice giver, a planner, you also have to ask them point blank, do you have the training to be able to answer these specific questions and have them explain the training? If you have tax questions, you better make sure they understand taxes. Now, some will say to you, oh, we don't give tax advice. Well, if you need tax planning and your firm's not going to give you tax advice, you might need to go to another firm. And then finally, some of the things you can ask is, who's going to actually be doing the work? Is it the person you're speaking to, or is it someone else? You might be speaking to someone who's a CPA / PFS or a CFP or any other designation on the planning side, or a CIMA or CFA person on the investment management side, but the people actually doing the work might be someone totally else, totally different. So you do have to ask, who's actually going to be doing the work? Now, if you have an ensemble practice similar to Chris and I, we tell people, or at least I mostly am the one who talk initially to people, I'll tell them, I don't do the planning, Chris does. We have Bob who does the taxes, Travis does the investment management. We have the professionals on board who all have their own place. But Travis doesn't do planning, Chris doesn't do investments, Bob doesn't do what Chris does. Everybody has their own areas of expertise. Bob's a CPA, Travis is the CFA, Chris is the CFP and his team. And we all have the professionals who will do things. Other planners are solo practitioners, and we are not judging solo practitioners. But you have to make sure, if they are a solo firm, that they at least have knowledge in the areas that you are going to need help with. A lot of people like working with solo firms because the person that they're working with is always there. And that's great. And that's a viable model. And I would say most advisors probably are solo practitioners.
And they might behave like solos, because a lot of offices, when you have a client, even there, if there's several planners or advisors in the same office, they're really just sharing the physical space. They have their own dedicated clients and they don't hand them back and forth. So you're literally dealing with just one of them, even if it looks like it's a firm of multiple people. Firms like ours, we all share in it, trying to contribute our areas of expertise so that we try to get the best information into the plan possible at a level above what we believe no one person could ever achieve. It's difficult to be an excellent top-of-the-line performer in every discipline. It's difficult to have the time to learn that much and to practice that much. So we find it's a little bit better to do it the way we do it when you've got a lot of complex areas that have to be addressed. But if it isn't particularly complicated and you have a skilled a single person doing everything you want isn't necessarily bad. But just make sure that they have the toolkit that is needed to solve your problems.
And then finally, something that a lot of people probably never, Chris, ever thought of asking. So here's another one, folks. And I guarantee you ask this question, people are going to look at you and think behind their facade, oh my goodness, where did they get this question? But ask your advisor that you're interviewing, who am I a client of? Who owns me? Am I a firm client? Or am I going to belong to a certain advisor who owns the client relationship? That's huge in our industry because so many firms, like that little folksy firm that advertises on TV all the time and has one man or one woman offices with one admin, you're not a client of that person. You are a client of the firm. And when that person leaves, if they ever did, that firm fights tooth and nail to keep you at the firm and assign you to someone else they choose.
Right.
You don't belong to that person who's running that folksy little one-person office. You find this a lot with what are called wirehouses. The client relationship is owned by the mothership, and they control where you go and who services you.
And control what that person you're dealing with
can say
can
and
do.
Exactly.
And say to you. So you might think this is coming directly from the mouth of the person sitting across the desk, but a lot of that is being influenced behind the scenes from the corporate wirehouse directive.
And that's what Chris was saying. There are sometimes there's ensemble practices that are really independent practices. And again, there's nothing wrong with this business model. The independent practices that band together to share rent and share admin staff, but they all run their own little businesses, if you will. You might think you're getting a whole group of people helping you. So if something happened to your advisor, they retire, they die, they quit, that someone else there is going to step right in and know what's going on. That's not the case. The relationship is not owned by the group because the group is just a bunch or several independent solo practitioners. You really need to know all this. So you have the corporate offices, if you will. And I guarantee you, if you're working with a corporate provider, and you all know who I mean, the big names in this industry, you do not belong to that advisor. You may think you do. All what you have is a relationship with that advisor. You are owned by the mothership. And if that advisor leaves, quits, gets fired, dies, you are passed on to whoever the mothership wants. So ask someone, who is the relationship with? Who owns my relationship? You or the corporate entity or the firm? Here at our practice, no one owns a client. The relationship is with our firm. In fact, I don't allow anyone who works here to go out and market and try to bring clients in. They're not allowed to. I don't let them run ads. I don't let them try to solicit. We don't need to. Chris and I do a very good job at finding people who resonate with our business model and want to work with us. But the clientele belongs to the firm. If I died tomorrow, Chris can step in and keep things going because he and Bob and everyone else know everything about the clients. We all share in them.
And this is how it's different than the big corporate model. And you might say, wait a minute, it sounds like the firm owns the client relationship like that big bad wirehouse that you were mentioning, Jim. The difference is here, while your relationship is with the firm, everybody here is participating in your planning process and your case and analyzing it, etc. And you're going to get to know most everybody in here some way. There'll be some type of interaction with several different people here. It's not just a one-on-one with one person constantly over and over and over again. So that's why if one cog in the machine were to move on or pass away or something like that, there's enough relationship with the rest that everything kind of just goes on smoothly. That's the nice part about our particular type of model and how it will evolve over time. The big corporate, you have no control. You'll be handed to someone you've never met or heard of, most likely. Might get lucky enough to be handed to somebody else in a similar office. Maybe you've heard of them. But it's likely that you would not have any kind of connection to this new person you're assigned to in this large corporate wirehouse model where you get handed off. And if you have the individual relationship, I think that lacks in a lot of cases because you don't get the benefit of the ensemble working with you with different experts trying to contribute. There's a lot of times with a client case where I might not have picked up on something I'm looking at, but when Jim is looking at it, he points out something and vice versa. And the goal, we do that on purpose so that we can contribute the best information, the best advice to a client case possible. So that's why we prefer our ensemble approach and the firm approach. There's more consistency over time, and I think the clients end up benefiting from the advice from many experts instead of just one.
I'll give you guys an example, which will probably surprise or shock some of you listening to this. Last year, I was chatting with a person. You all know, if you listen to our podcast, Chris and I's business model does not mandate people who hire us for planning also use us for investment management. Whereas many, many, many investment managers will not answer a financial planning question unless you move all your money over to them to manage. We don't have that model. But someone who was counseling with us and working with us had over $1 million at what is called a wirehouse. I'm not going to tell you which company it is, but just Google wirehouses, you'll learn what a wirehouse is. And at this wirehouse, they had all their money. And they asked me a question about how they should position the money. And I said, you really should be asking the person who's helping you manage your assets this question. Oh, well, we can't get a hold of them and this, that, and the other thing. And I was wondering if you could answer it. Well, as luck would have it, I am pretty good friends with a colleague from back east who works at this large wirehouse firm. National, actually probably international, probably in multiple countries. So I got a hold of him and I said, hey, I've got someone, they have an advisor there where they live in another state. They're positioned this way. They were wondering this, that, and the other thing. Can you help them? And what do you think his answer was?
He probably wasn't allowed to talk to him.
Exactly. You hit the nail on the head. He said to me, he says, Jim, I can't. He said, I will get in trouble if I talk to them. They don't belong. I'm not allowed. They're a firm client.
But the firm controls.
Who talks.
Right.
And they're assigned to this person. And I said, well, they don't like the person they're with. And what had happened is the person they were originally with years and years ago died. And they were assigned this other person. And there was just, they weren't getting along with them. And they had no control. I said, well, how can they get you? And he said, I can't take them on and I won't. Because it will cause a problem with my OSJ and his. OSJ stands for Office of Supervisory Jurisdiction. So what happens at these larger firms, you have the compliance person who's going to look over. They kind of run their own fiefdoms, if you will. And in there, they earn their money by getting an override of the production of the advisors, investment advisors who are working under them in that office and they're supervising. Well, if my friend worked to get those people over to him, the OSJ loses money.
Yeah.
And he said it would have caused a rift between my OSJ and his. And he refused to help. Yep. That's what we mean. Now, you all don't see any of this, folks.
Yeah, you're seeing, Jim's describing how the sausage is made behind the curtain.
Exactly. So I think asking someone who will own the client relationship, and if you leave the firm, who owns the relationship? Do I go with you? Or is my relationship owned by the firm? who's going to be doing the planning and who owns the relationship? Two very important questions, very different questions. Sounds the same to you, but very, very different questions. So it's just interesting if you start peeling back the onion and starting to look at how all these are structured. And that's part of the problem in the industry, Chris, because you have people who work for these big wirehouse national firms. You have people who work for small do-it-yourself firms, people like us who work for ensemble practices. You have insurance people who call themselves advisors and advisors who try to do insurance. It gets so confusing, Chris, because they're actually all different entities. Okay, so not quite sure if that caused more confusion or if you all found that interesting, but she then asks, how do I bring up fees? Every time I ask, and she puts in quotation marks, quote, what is my fee and what will be included, end quote, the answer they give me never answers my question. So I re-ask it something like three times, finally get frustrated and hang up the phone. Why don't you address this, Chris? Pretty much what she's saying is, I'm trying to find out what I'm going to pay, and no one can really tell me.
It's not that they can't tell you. They could tell you. They have to have this already designed. They're billing people right now. They have clients that they're charging. They know how they have that set up to charge people. They just don't want to. Because they, when they go down this path, they're not big fans of uncomfortable conversations. They much prefer someone who doesn't ask questions, that will just let them harvest whatever fee it is. They'll have to have divulged it legally, so it'll be somewhere in the paperwork that you end up signing. But like a lot of that stuff, some people read it and ask questions, and other people don't. They much prefer the people who don't, because they don't have to explain themselves. But the one that really gets, I think if she stopped at what is your fee, she might get a little more willingness to share, but she added a critical piece there.
Exactly.
The second part of that that I picked up on, what do I get for that?
What is included?
That just made the hair stand up on the back of their necks, because they're now feeling like they have to justify the fee, which we think they should. They should be able to justify it. If they can't justify it, that means they know in their mind that what they're charging is too much for what they're giving. If you truly believe that what you're providing is worth every penny that you're charging, you have no problem describing the cost and listing what you get for that and defending why it's worth it. Now, obviously, someone could disagree and say, no, I don't think it's worth it, and they don't hire that person. But anyone who honestly, we have no problem when someone asks us, we find out what they want, we talk about what we can deliver to them, we tell them what it's going to cost. Full stop. That's how it should work in our minds, in our, you know, in our dream of how this industry should evolve. But the thing that really sets them off, I believe, isn't so much what's your fee, but what's your fee and what am I going to get for that? The what am I going to get for that actually is far more concerning to them than the what's my fee. But the two together really, really bothers them, as she found out, because it's immediately putting them on the defensive, having to explain themselves. And a lot of times they're going to charge someone a lot of money, tens of thousands of dollars for a lot of you listeners who are out there that have done well and saved for a long time. If they're a traditional AUM practice, taking 1%, you've got a couple of million dollars with, they're going to be paid $20,000 a year in fees. Having to explain what you get for that and justify that, it makes them very, very uncomfortable. They would much prefer the docile client that doesn't ask any questions. Doesn't mean you have to be that, though. There are people that will give you that answer.
And a lot is going to have to do, listener, to if you are talking with a financial planner or an investment advisor. You should begin, because she says, how do I bring up fees? Well, you bring it up simply by saying, okay, let's talk about how you're going to be paid. That's how I would begin the conversation. And then you should ask them, point blank, will you give me financial planning advice without needing to manage my money. And if you are looking for someone to do financial planning and not an investment advisor, if their answer is no, I have to manage your money. They're the AUM people that Chris is saying. AUM stands for assets under management. And the new one, AUA, assets under advisement. This is the answer to all you people who've got millions in 401ks and don't want to move it. They're starting to charge you now on assets that they're going to give advice on. So they call it assets under advisement. And they're going to charge you a percentage. Oh, you got $1 million 401k, you're not moving it, but I'm going to give you advice on it, so I want 1% of that as well. But that's called assets under advisement or assets under management. Those business models will not give you financial planning advice unless you move your money. So if you are looking for a financial planner and you ask them, how are you going to be paid? Will you give me financial planning advice without having to manage my money? If the answer is no, you're probably in the wrong office. If it's yes, good. Now they should just be giving you a flat price. Now that said, even in our practice, we will quote a price but warn people. There could be, we call them programming surcharges. And one is, for instance, if your plan failed, if we're doing a retirement analysis and your plan fails and we have to now work with you at fixing it and programming different hypotheticals, we do charge additional for that because it's more programming work. So they should warn you. They should say, look, our base price or our flat fee is this. But in our practice, if this, that, or this happens, there might be a surcharge or a programming surcharge. We would never implement a surcharge without your prior approval and talking to you about what's causing the surcharge. And you can ask them, can you give me some examples of where these surcharges might apply? And then you can kind of figure out if they're going to apply to you or not. In our practice, the big ones are if people have very poor tax records and our tax team has to start digging and figuring out taxes to be owed, especially on the sale of real estate with depreciation recapture, we have to charge a little bit more for that for Bob to dig into it. And, of course, when a plan fails. So we disclose all this to people and tell them, here is our flat price. We intend to do the job for this price, but here are two things that might happen. We don't know. We haven't looked at you yet. And oftentimes, Chris, people will say, oh, I don't own any real estate. I don't have any depreciation. That one won't apply to me. Or they'll say, hey, I do have real estate, but I've got a tax person who's been doing this for years. They've got the taxes all figured out. I'm not going to need you guys. So if you're looking for a planner, they should be giving you a flat price. Now, if you're looking for an investment advisor, does it get easier or more difficult, Chris, to get an answer?
More difficult.
Exactly.
Yeah, by far more difficult because a lot of their fees that they've historically been able to charge have been because they've been obfuscated or behind this veil of confusion and secrecy. They might say, no, we divulge it right in all of the agreement that they signed. We divulge all this legally, so we're not hiding anything. That's like falling back on the fine print in a long contract. If you're not pointing it out and explaining it in plain English, you're not being upfront.
Now,
personal opinion.
To me, if you're working with an investment advisor and there's, again, nothing wrong with the investment advisor model, and you're looking for an investment advisor, you're not looking for planning, you're looking for investment advising. So you're interviewing people to manage your money. Here's where it's going to get difficult because you need to find out. They might say, oh, well, we charge 0.5% to manage or 1% to manage or 1.3% to manage. You're going to get all different prices. You should ask them first, are you charging me a tier or are you charging me a break point? And that is important. Let's say you had $1 million and the investment advisor said to you, we would manage that $1 million for 0.25%. I mentioned this because I was at lunch yesterday with a colleague, and I asked him, what do you charge to manage $1 million? And he said, 0.25%. Or actually, he didn't word it that way. He said to me, 25 bips.
Right.
That's someone in the industry. He'll say 25 bips, 25 basis points, 0.25%. And I said, for the entire million? And he says, Oh, no.
Yeah. Oh, no.
And let me say in full disclosure, I like this guy a lot. He's a really nice colleague and a friend. He says, No. The first 250, they pay 1%. Then from 250 to 500,000, they pay, I think, 0.8%. 500,000 to something, they pay this. And at a million, the next dollar gets charged.
Right. So everything over a million is 0.25.
Right. But, yeah. So what I'm saying is, if they answered, if your question was, what would I pay to manage a million? You got to be careful that they don't just say 0.25%. They're not going to say to you 25 basis points because they know you don't know what they're saying. 0.25%, 0.25. Now, my colleague, my friend at lunch, was not trying to pull the wool over my eyes. I just asked him, what do you charge for $1 million? He told me 0.25%, 25 bips. But then he had to clarify. So that type of pricing model is called a tiered model, folks. They're going to charge one price, one price, one price at different levels of assets. Why is this important? Because of the way they say it to you. If they were to say, well, how much money are you bringing over? Well, I'm going to bring over $1.1 million. Oh, at a million and more, it's 0.25. I'm telling you, some will say that. They're not lying per se, but they're just not being totally truthful, yeah. Chris.
And that's that veiled, not being quite upfront with people stuff I'm talking about.
So, yes, at a million or more, it's 0.25. But everything below a million is at different levels. So, in addition, well, that's called a tiered. There's another one called a breakpoint. If my colleague, Chris, was doing a breakpoint and at a million or more, it was 25 basis points or 0.25% or 0.25%, whatever you want to call it, 1.1 million would cost what, Chris? 0.25.
Right, 0.25 of the whole thing.
For the whole thing.
Because they went past the breakpoint, so the entire thing gets charged at that new rate. That's the difference. They don't retain it. So it's just two ways of describing the same thing, but you're still talking about this percentage of assets. It's just being applied differently.
So here's how I want you to do it. If you had $1.1 million and you're interviewing investment advisors, you're looking for investment advice, and they're giving you all these different percentages, ask them this. To hell with your percentages.
Right. What's the dollars?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I would say it that way. Yep. To hell with those percentages. I want to know in dollars, if I gave you $1.1 million and assuming my account did no growth, it didn't drop, it didn't rise, it stayed flat for the entire year, what am I paying in dollars? They have to tell you. And that's where you're going to get the actual dollar amount. And if it was $1 million and he comes back and says $2,500, I have a break point. And as long as you're at a million or more, you pay 0.25, 25 bips. If it didn't rise or fall, it's $2,500. But if you had $1 million, and they come back and they say, oh, that's going to end up costing you $8,259. You know it's probably a tier. And you're being charged different amounts at different levels. So just tell them, in dollars, tell me what I'm going to pay. And I would be as forceful as that, folks. You're paying the money. I have seen people who are paying tens of thousands of dollars a year, a new car every year to an investment advisor, and they don't know what they're paying.
The frustrating part is, even as difficult as it might be to get this dollar amount out of them, the second part is, like I said, oftentimes more difficult.
What am I going to
get? Maybe they'll
for?
Give you the, oh yeah, it's $82.50 or whatever Jim said it was. Now you at least know what it is. And then you ask them, well, what
are you going to do?
What do I get for that? They should be able to tell you. They should be able to tell you. Oftentimes it'll be some obscure dance that they're going to dance around the issue, describing all these kind of buzzwords about what they're going to do, and you get X number of meetings per year. But if you really, at the end of them talking, if you can't write down a list of all the stuff you're going to get, they danced around the question. They didn't really give it to you.
And one of the other things, and it kind of gets a little off base, but something when you're dealing with investment advisors, ask them point blank, are you going to benchmark my portfolio so I can track and measure the value that you are providing? And if so, what benchmark are you going to use? What are you going to say?
Now you're really telling them to make the person there.
Oh, they're going to be screaming.
Cringe. Yeah, this is more than just hair on the back of their neck. This is going to be, oh my gosh, how do I get out of this meeting, is what a lot of them are going to be feeling.
But how else are you going to track what they're doing? We benchmark all our client portfolios to Morningstar risk-adjusted benchmarks.
Right. Not to benchmarks we came up with. That's
right.
The key. The few that even say that they benchmark oftentimes will, when you press them further, you'll find out that they benchmark against a portfolio that they designed.
That's
as
called
the
a
benchmark.
Custom benchmark.
Right. So they essentially are, it's like running a race against yourself. How are you going to know if you're any good? Right? That's a ridiculous statement. I'm going to measure how fast I can run by measuring how fast I run against myself as my own competitor. That does not give you the kind of information as if you run against a third party that you don't control. That's the difference. Having a third party respected independent benchmark to measure against. And we're not even saying they must prove that they beat the benchmark to justify what they're charging.
Absolutely not. They should tell you. We're not going to.
They may not beat it. They oftentimes won't, but they should be able to explain why.
Right,
and
exactly.
Then you still feel like, oh, now that I know that, I'm still comfortable paying you for your advice on this because what you told me makes perfect sense.
We tell all our clients, we're going to benchmark you to these benchmarks depending on which model you choose from us. We make sure if someone is in our moderate model, we benchmark them to the Morningstar risk-adjusted moderate portfolio. I'm not going to benchmark my moderate portfolio to the Morningstar conservative growth portfolio, a portfolio intended to grow less than my model. That would be silly. So we'll tell them that. We'll make sure the benchmark matches what they're having us do, so it's an appropriate benchmark, in other words, folks. And then we tell them, you're not going to beat it most years. The benchmark is devoid of economic reality. It has no taxes. It has no trading cost. Has no rebalancing. No custodial fees. No advisory fees. It's just a measuring line. We are going to use it to make sure your correlation is tracking the risk you told us you want to assume. What does correlation mean? It means that our portfolio is zigging if the Morningstar benchmark is zigging. Ours isn't zagging if Morningstar's is zigging. That means we don't have correlation to the amount of risk our clients want. And then the difference in the return of the benchmark in our client portfolios should be able to be explained due to the fees of the investments within the portfolios, which nowadays are very low because of ETFs and indexing. We do a lot of passive investing. You Vanguardians would love that. Vanguard's a big part of our portfolios as well, but this isn't a commercial for us. But we explain the benchmark doesn't have any investment management fees or advisory fees. So let's subtract out our fees. Let's subtract out the investment management fees of the ETFs, which are very, very low. And then look at the cash flow timing. And here's where Chris uses a bus getting on and off example. Remember that example you explained once? We'll talk about this another day when we get into benchmarking. But depending on how often you put money in and take money out, because benchmarks don't have that, the portfolio can differ, can sometimes be far higher than the benchmark and sometimes be far lower. So we want to quantify to clients, hey, we are way above the benchmark. Don't get too excited. Here's why, blah, blah, blah. You did this cash flow item. So any investment advisor should have no problem with all of that. The issue is the high-priced investment advisors know net of the fees, the custodial fees, their fees, the fees of the investments, they're not going to come anywhere near the benchmark, and then they have to explain it and show it, and that's where the conversation starts to get ugly again. So their answer is they don't benchmark.
Right. They just don't do it.
We've talked about so much. That's a pet peeve of mine in this industry. You are going to hire someone to manage your money, and then they're not going to give you any way for you to see if you're getting what you're paying for. I just think that's nuts. So those are some questions you should ask when it comes to fees, listeners. But just come right out and ask them. And to hell with all these damn percentages. Tell me in dollars what I'm going to pay. Okay, here's what pet peeve of her, not a pet peeve, is something that really ticked her off, and it's because of the government. This next answer is because of the government. What documents do I need to open an account? Security does matter to me, but big company B, she's been dealing with three companies. She calls them big company A, B, and C. So she says, big company B required that I fax my driver's license to them. I chose not to go forward with big company B because of this. Big company B is doing what the Patriot Act passed shortly after 9/11 mandates. It's called Know Your Client, KYN in the industry. They have to prove you are who you say you are. I was dealing with a bank recently as I was applying for an account, and I had to take a photo of my license and upload it through my phone to their secure server before they would move forward, because I was dealing with them online. I wasn't in the office chatting with a banker. This was in the middle of COVID. Even today, I wouldn't go into an office right now with someone I didn't know. So I'm sorry, listener, they have to know the client and prove you are who you are. Anything you want to add on that one? I think that was a fairly straightforward one.
Yeah, no, some of them do. I don't know if she had a trouble with the fax element of it, which faxes actually are quite secure, at least the transmission part of it. Sometimes old technology is better than new, but or just handing over her driver's license. I'd be surprised if big company A and C didn't also require her to supply a government-issued photo ID to prove who she was. But maybe they had local branches and they just looked at it. If the person looks at it and attests that, yes, I verified their driver's license, I saw it, this is that person, she probably didn't have to hand over a copy of it in that relationship. But most of these, to cover their butts, because they can get in trouble if they're not doing this, they're asking for copies that they keep on file. So if they ever get audited or questioned, they can say, you know, here it is. Here's the, you know, this is them. This is the ID. We had every right to believe that they were who they claimed to be, and they seemed to prove it with what you asked us to obtain from them. So unfortunately, yeah, it's current law is a bit intrusive in that area.
Right. Here's another one that she had with big company C. And I have to say, Chris, I think big company C screwed up here. And they shouldn't have. Well, I don't know. They might have. So she says, help me to understand how representatives of a company and the companies themselves should communicate with me. She said, I work in medicine and I have to ask permission to discuss medical care of my patients with any family member. She said, but I was working with big company C, who I am in the process of transferring $1.5 million to. So we're not talking chump change here. And they one day talked to my husband about an action step that I needed to take. This is a hot button issue for me. It should be nothing about me without including me in the conversation. It took me over 6 hours on the phone over 4 separate days to find out what all this was about. I think big company C screwed up. If you were opening an individual account in your name,
yep,
just because you're married doesn't give them any right unless you gave them that right. And that's what I don't know. Some companies, as included on investment accounts, is there someone we can contact if we have a question about your account or about your own competency? Now, that's huge with the regulators, the second part, your own competency. Because legally, you are correct, listener. I cannot share information about a client with another family member, even if I think that family member is losing their mind. I can't, unless they gave me the permission. I'm under the impression, based on what she wrote, Chris, she never granted permission.
I think she never gave it or never intended to. I think the person who reached out called, got
the husband and thought, yeah,
and just thought, I bet he can answer this question. Big mistake.
Huge mistake.
Is a violation of privacy.
That's huge. Now, if you were opening a joint account, listener, and your husband was a joint owner, then nothing was done wrong. Or if you filled in that form, maybe you didn't realize you filled in the form because you hit with 30 pages of paperwork. Maybe on the form, you had given your husband permission to answer questions for you and you didn't realize it. But if neither of those two happened, big company C was wrong.
Yep, I agree.
Hands down. Mm-hmm. I'll give you guys an example that happened to me. Now, in our industry, Chris, the regulators have woken up to the fact, similar to what you and I have been saying for a long time on this podcast, as we age, our ability to understand financial concepts and our interest in financial matters diminishes. We've had some of our podcast listeners dispute that with us, friendly, not in an angry manner. But for the most part, we believe passionately and vehemently on this. Well, so now do the regulators, listeners. And they now have passed laws allowing us, even if people have not expressly given us permission, if we feel financial fraud is being committed against an elderly person, we can report it to our compliance departments, the police, elder services, and even family members if we knew them, and be protected from violating. But that doesn't seem to be what's happened here. This woman didn't say, I'm losing my mind, and they called up my husband. So they also, they being the regulators, strongly encourage us now when we open accounts to ask for names of people we can talk to if we suspect financial fraud is being committed against you or you need some help. I highly encourage people to list names there. This is to protect you. It is totally different than someone asking you, is there a name of someone if I have a question about your account I can get an answer from? And that seems to be what you ran into. They had a question on moving $1.5 million over. They called, they got your husband, and they involved him. And for some reason, it took you 6 hours to figure it all out of what they were asking and doing and why they were talking to your husband to begin with. So I can understand your frustration. But do remember that they are we are being tasked by the regulators to really help people as they age. And I think the younger you can help the older you by listing some names on this. So if the advisor, we've given some examples on recent podcasts, Chris, where if an advisor was involved in the situation, maybe what happened wouldn't have happened because the advisor would have picked up on a few things that didn't seem right. And if we had a name of who to contact, but I remember here, Chris, about 10 years ago, folks, I was working with I want to really protect their privacy here, but I was working with a person. And this person was an investment advisory relationship. And over time, I felt, Chris, this person was not remembering things. They were constantly contacting the office. When is my distribution check going to arrive? And we had already sent it weeks ago and already told them. And then they would call a few days later. When is my distribution check coming? Well, we had already sent it. So one day this person came to the office for a meeting. And I knew this person was still competent. I mean, they found the office. They didn't get lost finding the office. And were holding a good conversation. But I could feel, Chris, something's just not right. Well, I had no permit. There was no law 10 years ago allowing me to say anything to anyone. And I didn't know what to do. So what I did is I said, we normally send a recap. It used to be a written letter, but now it's all email. So if there's a meeting, I may recap what happened at the meeting. Some people like them. Some people say, nah, don't send that. I don't need it. So this person always liked the recap. Mm-hmm. So I just said to them, is there anyone else you would like me to send this letter to so they'll know what's going on just in case something ever happened to you? This person thought that was a wonderful idea and said, send it to my daughter. So in the letter, I referenced how this person was forgetting that the checks were being deposited and that we had agreed in the office together that we would contact her every time a check was being deposited. Within days of mailing that letter, I get a phone call from the daughter, thanking me and saying as a family, they were wondering if this was happening. And then I could talk to them about it and told them. And as it turned out, the person was diagnosed with dementia. So that's what I had to do 10 years ago. But I couldn't just send a letter to the daughter, nor could I reach out to the daughter. I had to have this person give me the permission. So the regulators now are saying, hey, today, if this happened, I could have contacted Elder Services. I could have contacted the police as if it's nefarious.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But I could have reached out to someone and been given some protections if I thought there was a problem. But back then, we didn't have it. Anyways, I just figured I would share that. Okay, and her final question. What are the different investment paradigms?
Paradigm.
Dime?
It's pronounced paradigms.
D-I-G-M is dime?
Yeah. It's a silent G.
Then it would be paradigms.
Well, it's pronounced dime.
Ah, oh, for Pete's sakes. I was wondering what a paradigm was.
Paradigm is a standard structure or standard way of doing things that's been established
over time. Well, they shouldn't spell it paradigms.
I didn't come up with it.
What are the different investment paradigms? There is a big bank investment paradigm. Then there is the independent advisor. Because she gets into company A now. We already talked about B and C. Here's her deal with company A. She said, and this is a long paragraph, so I'm going to try to keep it short. She said, I had errors from big company A I do not want to get into because of my concern that my social security number was incorrectly added to one of their other clients. I know you're going to think this sounds weird, but I received a statement for an inherited IRA titled Inherited IRA of, and she put in quotation marks, random man I don't know. And it was an IRA she inherited from her mother. But it was titled as an inherited IRA to some other random person. It took dozens of calls to big company A to get the date of death valuations on when I even inherited my non-IRA assets. And it took me a long time to convince them random man did not even belong on my account.
That's a weird one. That's bizarre.
So she didn't work with big company A because of this. The problem is...
Mistakes do happen.
Right.
That is true. I think a possible mistake. I think the bigger test for firms is how they address it. How they fix it. Do they fix it for you, make it easy to fix? Do they take the burden upon themselves to fix it, or do they burden you, the victim of the mistake? That would be kind of how maybe I'd judge, because I'm not going to stand here and say we never make mistakes. So I'm not going to be totally critical of a mistake like that happening. But how they handled it, their professionalism there, and the efforts that they put forth to solve it would be more indicative of the quality of the firm, in my opinion. But she thought that was, you know, something that didn't really attract her to A. Sounds like she's not a big fan of A, B, or C. She has issues with all three of them.
I think she has issues with all three of them. And she doesn't tell me the companies and the relationship. But in both situations, company A and company C, company C was the one who talked to her husband, and she said it took 6 hours on the phone to get an answer. Company A is the company who screwed up her app, and she's worried about her Social Security number now being shared or put on someone else's account by mistake. And as Chris said, mistakes can happen. But in both cases, she was on the phone a very long time. So it's telling me she is a do-it-yourselfer, not working through an advisor. Because one of the advantages, whether it's an independent ensemble firm like ours or even one of these wirehouses, you do have a relationship with an advisor. She could have gotten a hold of the advisor and said, hey, I just got a statement in that said someone else's name on the inherited IRA who I don't even know. And then that's it. That's all you have to do, because the advisor straightens it out. Now, his or her staff may be on the phone with big company A for 3, 4, 5 hours. That's not your issue. When you're dealing with an 800 number and not really someone who you know and are working with on a personal level, this is going to be a problem. You will be on the phone sometimes for a very long time because you're dealing with a big bureaucracy. And remember, the person answering the phone at big company A, B, and C, they're just entry-level phone reps. They don't have a lot of power. But you got to go through them to get assigned to someone else, to get assigned to someone else. And each time you generally have to explain what the hell is going on at each different place.
And in defense of the advisors that had trouble answering the question, what are you going to charge me and what am I going to get for it? I would definitely put this one on the what you're going to get for it. This is definitely something that happens, and so I would much rather call up the person I have a relationship with and say, hey, this happened, can you help me with it, and hang up, and then let them go spend all the time. That is a valuable thing, and that is something that they could contribute right to this list of things they're going to do for your fill-in-the-blank fee that they just had to divulge to you. So I will give them that. This is the type of thing they do, so make sure that you don't interpret Jim and I's criticism of some of these structures or paradigms that are out there.
Paradigms.
Yeah. So it isn't that we have a problem with them charging. But I think there should be an honest conversation or honest laying out what you're going to get and mentioning the types of things so that people know what they're getting for that and determine the value behind that. And it could be some very weird things like this that add value to that. So there are many things like this they're going to do for you as a support role. And there's some do-it-yourselfers say, no, I'd rather not pay this fee at all, do it all myself, and I'll just be the one who sits on the phone for 6 hours to solve any problems that might come up. That's certainly one approach. Other people don't want to mess with that, which means you pay someone else to take the time to do those sorts of things. But I'll just say this is one, you know, the type right. of thing you might include in that list.
I know if we were opening an account for someone and their statement came in and it was an inherited IRA and it had someone else's name on it, we're not going to tell our clients, well, here's the 800 number. You right. call up the custodian, try to figure this right. out, and let us know what they tell you. We would say, well, I'm sorry, Mr. and Mrs. X. This definitely is a mistake. We will get to the bottom of this. We will be in touch. And then my admin staff will figure it out. That's what I have an admin staff for. That's their job. They're going to go in. They're going to be the ones staying on the phone, figuring this all out. The fact that you are having to deal with this is telling me I think you might have decided not to hire any actual advisor to help you because that is something an advisor would do. So you do get something for the relationship that if things mess up, you can just tell one person, hey, can you help me fix this? And can you do most of the work? So anyways, I thought this was an interesting item. I thought we would be able to delve a little deeper into it, guys and gals, everyone listening to this, give you a little insight into the financial services industry of how it's kind of structured and help this person deal with her foray into trying to find someone to help her with her financial planning and her investment management and the difficulty she's having. So I thought it was interesting. Hopefully our listeners did as well.
Perfect. Well, that brings us to the end of a fairly long EDU show, actually. Lots of stuff going on in there, so you can see why we brought that email. A lot of things related to this quest that this person was on trying to find an advisor and just trying to get answers to her questions. Some of the answers or some of the questions she'd gotten from suggestions we've made previously on the podcast. But can be tough. Can be tough to get some of this, but it's not an impossible task. That being said, if you'd like to know a little bit more about what we do or would like to send some of your own ideas for the EDU show or questions for our Q&A podcast that we do, best way to contact us is go to the website, jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. On there, you'll find a contact form. You can reach out to us and pose your question or suggestion, if you will, for a show that you'd like us to do. You can also read a little bit more about us, our backgrounds, what we do, our process, our philosophy, why we do things the way we do. All that kind of stuff is on there if you haven't listened to all the podcasts that include that information. So if you want to reach out to us for any reason, that's the best way to do it, right there on the website, jimhelps.com. So thanks, everybody, for listening in again, and we'll be back with you next week with a brand new show. Investors should consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of investment company products carefully before investing. The prospectus contains this and other information about the investment company. Prospectuses may be obtained from your advisor and should be read in full. All guarantees are backed by the claims-paying ability of the issuing insurer. Withdrawals and death benefits are subject to income tax. If withdrawals and other distributions are received prior to age 59 and a half, a 10% penalty may apply. Shares, when redeemed, may be worth more or less than the original cost.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.